And that idea of meritocracy, I'm not saying we shouldn't have, you know, the great chairs of research. I'm not saying that we shouldn't allow the most brilliant people in specific areas to be brilliant. What I'm saying is, finding brilliance is far more complicated than we think. Intelligence is far more varied than the measurable approach we're increasingly taking. Far more varied. A democracy does not work without that understanding of the variety of intelligence. I mean, we just went for the second time to the Kickstart Festival, you know, which is for people with handicaps. And, you know, I bought a painting. I go into a lot of art galleries where there are paintings by people who don't have handicaps and don't buy paintings. I mean, you know, art comes where it comes. And interesting ideas come in the way that they come. And speed is not everything. You know, the meritocracies tend to make you think that everything's about speed, getting there fast, getting the answers. Whereas, in fact, a great deal in a society like Canadian society is going slowly, taking your time, coming at it in a different manner, listening to intuition, common sense, ethics, whatever it is that you want, using the great variety of forms of intelligence which exist out there. The exact opposite of a utilitarian approach towards education and intelligence. So is all of that too abstract? I don't think so, since you clapped it. The practical meaning is that I would draw out of that. Well, here we have the richest, has turned itself into one of the richest societies ever to exist in the history of the world. Richer than, you know, don't even listen to those things about, you know, world ratings of GDP, GNP, income, because they're all done. Who did the list? Who included what and left what out? I can tell you, I move around the world. This is, if not the richest society, one of the richest societies in the world. And we have done that for ourselves. We've made that happen. And yet, here this incredibly sophisticated, well-educated, rich society has convinced itself through these things I've described that it's too poor to have librarians. So it doesn't make any sense. So that we have eliminated, particularly in the elementary schools, eliminated more and more librarians, professional, proper librarians, with the result, of course, that the libraries are no longer open all the time, which means they're not properly used, which means there's no longer a reason to buy books, which, you know, it's a sort of slippery slope, and it just gets worse and worse once you don't have a full-time librarian. It's not so bad in the high schools, and that's great. Although, and I was talking with the principal here beforehand, most of the schools in Canada, the good high schools, have about a 15,000 a year book buying budget, and apparently it's about half what it used to be. So how can you continue to evolve and advance as a civilization when you're actually cutting the number of books available in the schools? And what does that mean in neighborhoods where the parents maybe don't read because they're immigrants or because they were brought up in a poorer situation perhaps and didn't read? You know, does that not lead us towards a class-based society as opposed to an egalitarian society? These libraries are key, and the libraries in the elementary schools are essential. Everybody knows now that you make or break real literacy when children are young. It's too late by grade 8 to deal with a great number of the problems which may come along. How much money is this? I know, and you know, I've talked with people who have to administer these budgets all across the country, and they're making terrible choices given the situation. But we cannot afford to allow these libraries to shut down, to move slowly. They have to be the nerve center of schools. People say, oh, well, no, it's all done on computers. That's not true. What happens on computers is usually text running from 500 to 2,000 words. Intelligence develops when you're reading books of 200, 300, 400 pages. And that's not something you find on a computer. Use the computers, but you have to read the books. That's where the imagination is released. And then, secondly, this astonishing shortage of textbooks. Who would have thought that we wouldn't have enough money for one of the cheapest things there is? Textbooks. That kids would be sharing textbooks, unable to take textbooks home. It's simply, if you actually stand back from it, it's a form of delusion reactivity to say that we can't afford to have textbooks for kids. Somebody told me today, I talked to a friend of mine here, and she said that her kids are using a textbook that deals, social sciences or history, that deals with Europe. And it was published in 1990. I mean, Europe is not, well, a couple of things have happened. That's a new one, yeah. And of course, again, upper middle class areas, and I believe this is one of those areas that I'm in here, you know, probably, you know, parents could buy the books or raise funds for them or whatever. Third outcome, the stripping down of what are called services, which I just thought were normal things. This is part of a utilitarian view of public education, that you only get certain things. You don't have the right to other things. They're a privilege and you have to pay for them because there isn't enough money. And I notice all across the country that the first area to be hit is the arts. And, you know, one of the signs of civilization is one is able to reach out beyond accountancy, not because accountancy is bad, but one is able to reach out to the areas where we think to ourselves and among ourselves about what kind of society we want to live in. And that happens through the mirror, through the mechanism of the arts. It always has. For thousands of years it's happened that way. Why would the most educated and the richest societies in the history of the world suddenly decide that they don't need the arts as a normal, central factor of their civilization, that it's an extra that you pay for? Fourth. The fourth, you know, one of the three basic theories of the philosophy of Canadian civilization is immigration. And we bring in 250,000 immigrants a year. We invite them in. It's our decision. And I think it's one of the most brilliant things that we do. But then to invite them in and then cut back on the number of ESL teachers, on the services, you know, we have, as we're holding the party, we're holding the party of the Canadian civilization, and therefore we have an obligation to feed the guests. And feeding the guests means helping them to adapt to their Canadian citizenship as quickly and as richly and in as complex a manner as possible. That's our obligation as Canadian citizens. So in other words, we have to. The outcome of all of this has been a sort of curious victory of utilitarianism. And I think the insertion of this ideology and these theories obscures just how well we're doing. I mean, we're told today that, you know, well, we need more choice and private will produce choice. And I'm not saying there shouldn't be private schools. Fine. People, if they want to have it, why not? But the tradition in Canada has never been that you had to go to private schools in order to get choice. The brilliance of the public education system has been its ability to adjust to situation after situation after situation and provide choices. This morning at Gladstone, they said, oh, we've got Montessori here. Oh, we're trying this out. It's going very well. It's becoming a leadership area in terms of volunteerism. Well, do you have it everywhere else? No, but we're trying it here. You know, that's the public school system or the French immersion system. I mean, Vancouver, I believe, has the highest per capita enrollment in French immersion in the country. Certainly BC does. Enormously successful program. Nothing utilitarian about it at all. Very interesting. And I know that world really pretty well because I have a program called French for the Future and I work a lot with the French immersion and Francophones in British Columbia. And they're on their way to apparently 40,000 in a few years, 40,000 kids in French immersion and 5,000 Francophones in French first language. An amazing success story, a story of choice inside the public school system. And now, this year, Simon Fraser in UBC for the first time, Simon Fraser is going to offer an undergraduate, I think, bilingual degree in arts, and UBC is going to offer about 4 or 5 courses in French so that people who are bilingual can continue at the university level as opposed to losing it. Again, it's a public university system. The volunteerism systems which are building up inside the public school system. This is a new thing. We didn't have that when I was in school. It's coming out of nowhere. The kids are saying they want to do it. Lots of teachers saying, I want to lead my kids in this way. And it's just growing up, and they're different everywhere. I heard about a whole bunch of new systems this morning that had been invented in this school or in Vancouver. And I tell you, Gunjo and I are in more public schools than probably anybody else in the country. And my general impression is they really work, and they work well. In spite of the difficulties which they face today and which I've just been describing. Now let me just finish by going briefly back to this question of stripping down the services. What it's doing, and everybody knows this, is it's forcing well-intentioned and enthusiastic parents to go out and fundraise for their schools. And one should not criticize them for doing that because, you know, they're trying to do something. But of course, in the larger picture, these locally self-imposed taxes create an imbalance in society. Again, because certain areas have the money and certain areas don't. I've just come from Fort Providence and Rayetso. Would they have the money to go out and, you know, fundraise? Would they in Prince George? Would they in Prince Rupert? I mean, you talk about the rich and the poor in Vancouver, but what about the rest of the province? If one creates a situation where certain areas can go out and make their situation okay, but it doesn't help the rest of the city or the province, then we've lost that most basic Canadian middle-class egalitarian principle, to say nothing of what it does to the immigrants again, who would also be largely left out in such a situation. Is this the fault of the upper middle-class parents? No. Not unless they actually actively and enthusiastically accept the theories which have led to them being shut up in this trap. I think most of them are pretty uncomfortable with the situation. But perhaps they don't understand how we got into the trap. And that's why I spent all that time talking to you about how we got there. What were the mistakes we made which led us into this situation where we think we can't act in any other way? So, we've never been richer. We're acting as if we're getting poorer and poorer. The society is complex and therefore demands a complex approach and an inclusive approach. And we're acting as if the smart thing to do is to simplify and get down to utilitarianism. We have a decline in long-term stable situations, you know, long-term employment, marriages, societal structures, enormous amount of instability in society, not necessarily disastrous, but a lot of instability in society. If ever there was a moment not to concentrate on utilitarianism, this was it. Why? Because in an unstable moment, the kids need is an education which will allow them to use their brains to the fullest, to think intellectually, emotionally, ethically about how they're going to handle the situation for themselves, for their families, for their society. How they're going to deal with having five jobs instead of one job. That's not about training. That's about intellectual development. That's about a broad education. It's not about measurables. It's about the capacity to think, reading, debating, questioning, doubting. The Dahman's official view of what has to happen in education is that it has to become more and more specialist, more and more devoted towards the meritocratic approach, towards the utilitarian, go out there and get a job. We're going to live to be 90. You know, 100 years ago, the average age at which people died was 50. Now it's 90. And in fact, if you eliminate people like me, people being born today are going to live to be 100. There's really no rush. So why would we say to these kids, hurry up, get out there and get a job so you can retire, go on a cruise boat? I mean, I don't get it. It's because we're not thinking about the shaping of the society. This approach, this utilitarian approach, is the precise opposite of what is required today. I think the students are way ahead of the consultants. I think the students are way ahead of the ideologues. I think they're asking much more questions than the answers which are being given before the questions to our public officials. And the students, I think, are very uncomfortable, as the parents are very uncomfortable, with the direction which is being driven upon the society for reasons which nobody can really get a handle on. I don't think many of us or many of them believe that these problems are necessary or inevitable. But in order to get away from that sense of the inevitability of them, we have to open ourselves up completely to rethinking how we got into the current situation. We have to break the illusion of inevitability. We have to go back down that long line to 1840, 1848, 1853, 1873, and see where we've come from and try and figure out how we veered off course. Because the system's still working, but it can't go on working if we keep driving it off course. We have a limited amount of time in which to actually allow it to do what it does best, which is to open itself to the complexity of the day. Thank you very much.